From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Texas Rangers are a legendary law enforcement agency, but the lawmen have a dark side that has virtually been covered up in the telling of Texas history. Is it time to set the record straight?
The Rangers, acting under orders, met with police chiefs and sheriff's departments across the state and actively conspired to violate the civil rights of the black citizens of Texas. They talked about infiltrating and disrupting the meetings of citizens who were seeking equal rights.
And a view of the George Floyd protest through the long lens of time and experience.
I am a black woman who has witnessed my share of protests, rallies, and riots. They are outward demonstrations that represent internal realities, struggles that have shaped our times.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. One Riot, One Ranger. It's the title of a statue that stood since 1962 at Dallas Love Field Airport. But days ago, that bronze figure of Texas Ranger Jay Banks was quickly removed. City and airport officials decided to remove that statue after reading an excerpt of the book Cult of Glory, The Bold and Brutal History of the Texas Rangers by Douglas J. Swanson. In the book, Swanson sets out to correct the public narrative of the Texas Rangers with an accounting of their role in racial violence and oppression against African Americans, Native peoples, and Mexican Americans in Texas. I spoke to Swanson about his book and the removal of the Banks statue.
Well, they're taking it down. It was a complete surprise to me, I have to say that. I didn't know about it until I read about it on a news site, and I was quite stunned by it. They didn't consult me. But here's what I know. I had written a chapter in the book that involved the statue, and it was run as an excerpt in D Magazine, the city magazine of Dallas. Now, what I wrote was that the statue was completed back in 1959. The model for it was a ranger named Jay Banks. Jay Banks was very handsome and muscular, so he was a natural model for this statue. It had been commissioned by a Dallas businessman and donated to the city of Dallas. The problem was that in 1956, the NAACP was trying to integrate Texas schools, and they started with Mansfield High School between Dallas and Fort Worth. Governor Alan Shivers was not in favor of integration. He sent the Rangers to keep the peace during this integration effort. And what that meant was the Rangers were to arrest any black students who tried to enroll in Mansfield High School, and then a week later at Texarkana College. Jay Banks was in charge of the Rangers on those occasions at the scene, and there was a very famous photograph taken of Ranger Banks at Mansfield High School. He's leaning up against a tree in a very relaxed manner, and to his left, hanging above the entrance to the high school, is a black figure hanging from a noose in effigy. Now, this photograph went worldwide. So Ranger Banks became, for better or worse, at the time, sort of the public face of Texas's efforts to block integration. So I pointed this out in my book and in this piece I wrote for D Magazine. And once that excerpt ran, the officials at the city of Dallas and at the airport apparently read it and decided this statue has to go. And the next morning, it was gone. They sent in city workers at 6 o'clock in the morning and took that thing down. And where it is now, I have no idea. But that's the story as I understand it.
So Captain Jay Banks, he was the model, the inspiration for the statue. And what was Banks an outlier from what the Texas Rangers, how they operated in the state? When he went to East Texas, became very friendly with the forces, with the political forces there that did not want to integrate.
That's right. And we have to point out that Banks was only following orders. He didn't set out himself to block integration. However, when he went to Texarkana a week after Mansfield, he met with the representatives of the White Citizens Council, which, as you know, this is an anti-integration group mostly composed of business leaders and political figures, and it's often referred to as the Uptown Klan. You know, they didn't dress up in hooded costumes and go out and burn crosses, but they very much were opposed to integration, and Banks became very friendly with them, and they were so happy about his efforts to block enrollment at Texarkana College by a young black woman and a young black man that when he left town, before he left town, they gave him a chicken dinner. They were all friends at that point.
Your book is not specifically about Ranger Banks. It is a Cult of Glory, is about the breadth of the Texas Rangers and the good and the bad.
That's right. It starts in 1823 when the first Rangers came into existence, the Proto Rangers, and goes up to the present day. And I try to talk about the heroic Rangers, because certainly they're heroic Rangers, courageous, you know, tough guys. We wouldn't have Texas as we know it without the Rangers, and we have to give them their due. At the same time, you know, there's this Ranger image that has been manufactured over the years, this legend, and part of it is based in truth, but part of it is built on a fabric of cover-ups and misapplications, misrepresentations, and just outright lies. And so I try to address that too. I'm trying to tell the full history here of the full 200 years.
The Texas Rangers, they're coming up on their 200-year anniversary. What will that anniversary be like now that your book has been released? And it seems like there's shockwaves coming from your book, Cult of Glory, because it really hasn't been talked about. There's a dark side of the history of Texas Rangers.
I have to say that there have been a number of very excellent scholarly works and books of history about the dark side of the Rangers, but they haven't entered the mainstream as much as perhaps they should have. And, you know, some of them were for academic presses, some of them were for publications that you might, or most people may not read. So it's not that this hasn't been written about, it's just it hasn't gotten a lot of attention. And it often was written about discrete pieces of the Ranger history. So I tried to put it all together across, you know, the entire almost 200 years. Now, how will the Rangers mark their 200th anniversary? Well, you know, this being Texas, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of celebration and self-aggrandization, that sort of thing. But I'm hoping that some other viewpoints and other voices are considered. You know, let's talk about why were the Rangers so feared along the border by Tejanos and Mexican Americans in the early part of this century. You know, why were they regarded, as one politician said, as feared as the KKK was in the Deep South? And, you know, we need to talk about that too.
Were the Texas Rangers, particularly in that era of Jim Crow and then post-industrial Texas and moving into modern Texas, did the Rangers operate as the fist of oppression for the white hierarchy?
Certainly. Sometimes, yes. I mean, one example I have, and I found these papers in the Briscoe collection at the Center for American History, or the Briscoe Center for American History at the University of Texas at Austin. I had not seen them written about anywhere. Back in 1919, the Rangers, acting under orders, met with police chiefs and sheriff's departments across the state and actively conspired to violate the civil rights of the black citizens of Texas. They talked about infiltrating and disrupting the meetings of citizens who were seeking equal rights. They talked about blocking the mail delivery of black citizens who were receiving newspapers from out of town, like, you know, pro-black publications from Chicago and New York. They talked about, or they planned to have gun shop owners refuse to sell weapons to black citizens, even though that, you know, was legal certainly for black citizens to buy guns. And the whole movement was aimed at keeping down black efforts to seek equal rights. I mean, this was very active, and there's no doubt it occurred.
But right around this time, we had what was called the Bandit War, or the Plan de San Diego, happened in South Texas, basically having this undeclared war against Mexico, where they would send bandits into South Texas, and then the Texas Rangers would respond with brutality, and that they had been given carte blanche to basically attack any Mexican that they would find in that area.
That's correct. That was in the early part of the 20th century, 1911, 1912, 1913, 1914, in there, and a few years after. Yes, the Plan of San Diego was supposedly a plan that Mexico was going to retake parts of Texas, and all white Texans over the age of, I think, 16 were going to be executed. Now, how legitimate was this plan? I don't
know. Well, it's like a conspiracy theory. It was like on the internet of the era. This is the conspiracy theory that was floated, and it gave power to people who wanted to oppress Mexican-Americans at the time.
Exactly. There were other forces at work. I mean, Mexico was in political turmoil at the time. There were indeed some bandits coming over from Mexico to raid white ranches. But what was also going on is there was a land boom in the Rio Grande Valley at the time. A lot of whites coming in from the north and the Midwest, buying land, running up the prices. And this was land that Mexican Americans had been on for generations. And the white ranchers and the white developers wanted them forced off. The Rangers did that for them, sometimes just by running them off, sometimes by killing them, sometimes by burning them out. When it was all done, the Rangers had murdered hundreds and perhaps thousands, depending on your source, of Mexican-Americans and Mexicans. Some of them, as I said, were bad guys, but a lot of them just committed the crime of having brown skin. And, you know, there were terrible atrocities that took place during this period by the Rangers.
There was basically a statewide scandal when this came to light, and there was an investigation by the Texas House, and the result was an attempt to reform the Rangers?
Yes. A state representative, J.T. Canales from the Valley, convened some legislative hearings. And you can read the transcripts now. They're online with the State Archives website. Runs more than 1,000 pages, but it's fascinating reading. It just lays out the Ranger atrocities in black and white. And Canales didn't want to abolish the Rangers. He wanted to reform them. He wanted to make them more professional. But as often happens in the Texas legislature, it got watered down, and very little reform took place. And in the end, Canales said, "I don't recognize my own child," meaning the legislation that he proposed. So that reform effort pretty much fizzled out.
Under Governor Ma Ferguson, she had her own ideas on what to do with the Texas Rangers. What was her reform?
Her reform was to make things worse. So the Rangers had endorsed her opponent, so they were in bad shape when Ma Ferguson took over. And she fired all the Rangers. I brought in her own bunch of friends, cronies, hacks. And at that point, the Rangers probably reached their lowest moment. They were extraordinarily corrupt. They would do things like raid casinos, throw out the owners of the casinos, the operators of the casinos, and then start operating themselves, these casinos. Or they would stop motorists and demand bribes. So they would demand bribes from people they arrested for other crimes. They were just completely corrupt and inefficient and doing a terrible disservice to the state. Once Ferguson was out of office, there was another effort to reform the Rangers in the mid-1930s, and this time it stuck. The Department of Public Safety was formed, and the Rangers were put under the umbrella of Department of Public Safety, and they started taking some steps toward becoming a more professional, well-trained, competent law enforcement organization. Now, that took some time, took some decades for them to get there, in fact. But that's when the reform really started to take hold.
They were on basically a starvation budget at the time under Governor Pasta Biscuits Papio Daniel, that they had no money even for ammunition, that they would have to go to local law enforcement and beg for ammunition for their weapons.
You know, that's the funny thing about the Rangers. They're such a part of Texas history and so celebrated At the same time, they've always been underfunded. Going back to the very beginning, the pay has been low. They had to furnish their own weapons, their own ammunition, their own horses, or they weren't paid sometimes. They've been, up until recently anyway, they've been starved by the state. That has gone on throughout, and that's the ironic thing. For a group that is so celebrated and so revered, they've had to scrimp all along.
I remember the first time I met a real-life Texas Ranger when I was a young reporter down in Laredo, Texas, and he had come to do some investigating. And you could just tell there was something about this man that struck you, like he was different. He was a Texas Ranger.
Oh, yeah, they've always had an aura about them. I've met a number of them, too, in my work as a newspaper reporter, and I've always had good relationships with them. But, yeah, you can identify a Ranger from 100 paces, just the way they carry themselves. And, you know, that's part of what they learn. But this propagating of the legend, it goes way back, and it often just doesn't hold up to fact. I mean, I looked at one, for example, James Callahan, for whom Callahan County in West Texas is named. He's buried in the Texas State Cemetery, and on his tombstone, it says he pursued Indians into Mexico in 1855. Well, that's true, but what it doesn't say is that most scholars agree that what he was actually doing in Mexico, he and his fellow Rangers, he was trying to capture runaway slaves and bring them back to Texas to sell them. Now, the whole mission was a disaster. He and the Rangers had to burn down the town of Piedras Negras to escape Mexico, and he was in disgrace at the time. However, for the next decades or so, several decades, there was an attempt to rehabilitate Callahan's reputation from his friends in the legislature, his friends with the Rangers. Numerous stories and newspapers appear talking about how heroic he was and how he whipped the Indians and whipped the Mexicans, and no mention was made of slave trading and slave hunting. That disappeared. And then the county was named for him.
So wasn't he hired to do that by business leaders in San Antonio? And he put together like a posse, and he was supposed to shut down the Underground Railroad that went into Mexico. And then he goes into Piedras Negras, and then he is met by a group of Seminole Indians, runaway slaves, and Mexicans who were just done with all this. And he got his hat handed to him.
All that is correct. But that's the truth that got buried in the subsequent years. That you're right in every aspect of that, except if you go back and read about Callahan in the Texas newspapers of the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, none of that is mentioned. He is a hero, and that's how it developed.
But Hollywood also played a major role in ginning up this image of Texas Rangers who were demigod-like.
Oh, yes, a big role. And there are hundreds of films that fit this mold. Part of it is because, you know, people loved watching these sorts of movies. And the Texas Ranger, just the name itself is so evocative. And it was full of Wild West shootouts and Indian fights and all that. And people loved that. Part of it is because the Rangers encouraged it. And if you go back and look at some of the television programs of the 1950s and 1960s, which were very positive toward the Rangers, and there's a reason for that. Homer Garrison, the head of DPS, had script approval of any TV show that wanted the Rangers' cooperation. And they had to present the Rangers in a positive way that pleased the Rangers themselves.
Even on like the program Walker, Texas Ranger with Chuck Norris, which was a major television series in the 90s?
I can't tell you that they had to seek script approval for that, but that was certainly a positive image of the Rangers. And, you know, it's a silly one, too. There are very few Rangers, if any, walking around with Chuck Norris's martial arts skills. But that's, you know, perhaps the uber example of all of this. What this has all led to. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to watch if you don't take it too seriously, but its relationship to the truth is extraordinarily thin.
So today, what is the role of the Texas Rangers in law enforcement?
They have a couple of roles. You know, they investigate official corruption, if a politician or a government official, rather, is accused of some sort of crime, the Rangers will investigate. They have some intelligence operations along the border, for which I don't know much because they wouldn't talk to me about it or wouldn't let me visit them. And there's been very little in the way of coverage about them. What they do and what they have done for a long time, is a very crucial role, I think, is they assist small town, small county police departments and sheriff's departments in the investigations of crimes. If you're a sheriff in a really rural West Texas county and you have a couple of homicides, you know, you may not have a homicide detective on your staff. So you can get the Rangers to come in and help you. They do that a lot. I spent the day with a ranger, Brandon Bass, down in Liberty County, East Texas. Great guy. And he showed me all the murders and assault cases he's working on for various departments, police departments and sheriff's offices down in East Texas. So the Rangers provide a valuable service in that way.
They also investigate deaths in county jails.
Yes.
And that seems like getting information out of them about these cases, it's very difficult. It seems like when you're a reporter and you see that the Texas Rangers have taken over investigation, you can forget about ever hearing anything about this until it's settled.
Yeah, that's a problem. That was a problem for me researching this book. And I don't know how much to put at the foot of the Rangers and how much to put at the foot of the umbrella organization, the Department of Public Safety. DPS... in my experience, has not been forthcoming for a number of years regarding public information. Now, if you can go talk to an individual ranger, and I've done that on some stories I've been working on, I found them very candid and forthcoming. But getting information out of the Department of Public Safety itself, I have found very difficult, and I think others too have too, on jail deaths, on border arrests, on statistics of border crossings, on what DPS is doing down on the border. I had a very difficult time getting anything from them, both as a reporter at the Dallas Morning News and writing this book. And I think other reporters have had the same experience.
It seems like Texas needs to have this legend of Texas Rangers. That is essential to the fabric of the myth. Does that ring true to you?
Oh, I think so. I'm pretty old, and I've spent half my life in Texas. I don't live there now, but I've spent half my life there. And I mean, that's part of the thing I think we all love about Texas, that sense that there's no place like it. It is this wonderful land that has this great tradition and terrific characters, and we celebrate it. And the Rangers are part of that fabric. However, I think it's far more important than just looking at the legend. It's far more important to examine the entire history. It's fascinating, but it also gives voice to those who haven't maybe been heard as much as they should have. It gives us viewpoints that perhaps we've ignored before. And that makes for a far richer history, far more interesting history, far fairer history. And I hope when the 200th anniversary rolls around that those are taken into consideration, because I think we owe it to, you know, as Texans, we owe it to each other.
Douglas J. Swanson is the author of the book Cult of Glory, The Bold and Brutal History of the Texas Rangers. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. The death of George Floyd at the hands of four former Minneapolis police officers is prompting massive protests throughout the United States and around the world. Even today, 2 weeks later, protests continue, but they do so as the COVID-19 pandemic reasserts itself. How can protesters continue to demand racial justice if the pandemic makes showing up a risk to their and their family's health? Texas Public Radio guest contributor, our reporter, offers these thoughts.
I am a Black woman who has witnessed my share of protests, rallies, and riots. They are outward demonstrations that represent internal realities, struggles that have shaped our times. Currently, the energy is in the streets, where both interracial and intergenerational Americans are raising their voices against police brutality and systemic racism. If for some reason you cannot be there, what can you do? The hot Texas summer of 1954 presented an opportunity for black children in San Antonio to take a dip in the segregated Woodlawn swimming pool. The pool was closed shortly afterwards for cleaning. Most black homes featured three pictures prominently: Jesus, Martin Luther King Jr., and President John F. Kennedy, all symbols of the hope these families had for better days. In the 60s, protests for voting and civil rights held in the South garnered some success. However, violence erupted as our civil rights leaders were murdered and the hope on which black families depended was shattered. The murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police has sparked an outcry of Black Lives Matter, no justice, no peace, and I am not a threat. Across the nation and throughout the world, the quest for justice has been reignited. That quest is complicated by COVID-19. Some are struggling to determine just how to be a contributory voice. How much risk is too much? What do you do? The energy need not only be in the streets. Our protest history has produced powerful works of music and literature during times such as this. Sam Cooke penned, "A Change Is Gonna Come," to raise awareness about the struggles of African Americans living in the Jim Crow South. The song became a civil rights anthem. Author James Baldwin wrote "The Fire Next Time," which discussed the central role of race in American history. Sheldon Benn, in his New York Times review at its publication, called it a warning and a hope. Chancellor Williams, "The Destruction of Black Civilization, Great Issues of a Race from 4500 BC to 2000 AD, contains a voluminous history of African people and the resulting impact of slavery. Every book on the current New York Times nonfiction bestseller list is about race. Titles like So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijeomeo Oluwaseyi. These and other works can provide an intimate look at issues at the crux of current race relations. There is a multicultural chorus of voices that have poured into the streets, but if you cannot be there, bring the streets inside. Be inspired. Educate yourself and others. Ensure our children know their history. Contact your respective congressperson and make your requests known. Encourage others to speak out. Write. Meet your neighbors. Support black artists. Do not be comfortable with the status quo. Vote at the local, state, and federal level. They all matter, no matter how long you must wait in line.
That was Texas Public Radio guest commentator Ari Porter. Ari is an MFA thesis candidate in the MA-MFA program in Literature, Creative Writing, and Social Justice at Our Lady of the Lake University. She is the creator and publisher of Nubian Notes, a local magazine maintained as a special collection at the John Peace Library at the Institute of Texan Cultures. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters episodes to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.